It's not like any other podcast, coming to you straight from the heartland, where investing is told like it is. It's time for Darren Garman's Paranoid Banker Podcast. Hold on, because here comes the next episode of the Paranoid Banker Podcast.
Well, hey everybody, Darren Garman here. I want to welcome you to this week's podcast. We're going to put a little different spin on our podcasts this week. We talk week in and week out about investing, and that always has to do with some kind of conversation, subject matter that has to do with where to invest your money, pretty much. We're going to put a different spin on it this week. We're going to talk about investing time. You know, if there's one thing that is a limited resource for all of us, it's definitely time. And you're going to listen to a couple of my investment partners who are considered the top people in their respective industries talk about wise investments of time, getting the most out of every day, and being a much more effective person at the end of the day when it comes to thinking about time investing and time management. It's a very interesting interview that you're going to be listening to on this podcast. Recommend you take the time to listen to it all the way through. And there's good stuff here for everybody. And again, we can't get time back. Once it's gone, it's gone. And so if we're talking investing, probably the most important investment any of us can make is in time and how we spend it. So, in a podcast that was recently just shared with my investment partners, we're going to share this information with you and hope you enjoy it. Without further ado, let's listen into Lee Miltier and Dan Kennedy as they talk to us about investing our time.
Welcome to Millionaire Smarts. This is Lee Miltier, and you're in for such a treat this month. Our celebrity expert is the one and only Dan Kennedy. Now, many people have heard me say that I predict that Dan Kennedy will be the Napoleon Hill of our generation. He is a multimillionaire from scratch, an active investor, a serial entrepreneur, a celebrated author, speaker, and entrepreneurial coaching legend, really, marketing strategist, consultant, and one of the highest paid direct advertising copywriters in the world. Now, we have the privilege of talking to Dan today about his book, The No BS Time Management for Entrepreneurs. Now, the subtitle is very important, The Ultimate No-Hold-Barred Kick-Butt Take-No-Prisoners Guide to Time Productivity Insanity. Now, this is the third edition of the same book, which was originally published in 1996, but has been totally updated to deal with many of the big time challenges that successful people deal with daily. Now, Dan's book will drastically re-energize you and re-engineer your entire relationship with the concept of time. Dan, in his book, says that the single biggest secret of extraordinary personal, financial, and entrepreneurial success combined is the use or misuse or the abuse of others of your time. Now, the degree to which you achieve peak productivity will determine your success. So, obviously, you've got to get your time under control. To really sum it up, what Dan does is break the code of sincerely successful entrepreneurs. So with all that said, please welcome my dearest friend, Dan Kennedy, to our call. Welcome, Dan.
Hey there. Glad to be with you.
Glad that you're here with us. Dan, you're most famous for many things, but I know one of the huge impact that you've made on me and my coaching groups and many people around the world is the importance of safeguarding your time, how to invest it, and how to bring wrath upon anyone who would try to steal it, waste it, or abuse it. Now, for someone who has really allowed their time to get away from them, today is our short time together that you're going to be sharing some of the inside key strategies that you used to be known as one of the most dedicated time and productivity managers alive. So my first question is really about your first chapter, which I love this. How do you turn time into money? So first, give us a real definition and mindset of an entrepreneur.
Well, the successful entrepreneur or the successful investor is always surrounded by more demands, more opportunities, more people vying for time and attention than he could possibly fulfill. So you have to begin dealing with time in the same way you deal with money. There are always more things to buy, more charities asking for money, deserving your support, more ways to dispense money than you have money. And it really doesn't matter, by the way, whether you have a million, 10 million, or a billion. The same thing is true. So if you don't exercise control and you just write a check for the requested amount randomly to whoever shows up first and whoever shows up second and whoever shows up third, you will run out of money in a completely disorganized, unprioritized, and unproductive way. And the same thing is true with time. So the first chapter is really about figuring out, coming to a conclusion by a mathematical exercise of what your hours and minutes must be worth in order for you to achieve your income and your wealth goals. And having that number now allows you to make some intelligent and discriminatory decisions. It allows you to do time budgets for various activities based on their worth or potential worth. In my case, for example, writing this book has a predetermined number of hours that it is permitted to consume based on its financial value, and it can't have any more time than that, no matter what. Same thing with a meeting, same thing with a phone conversation, same thing with whatever. And most people do not, you know, operate in this manner. They operate quite randomly, ceding control over the amount of time something is going to take to the thing. They cede access to others seeking it rather than to them protecting it. And so this chapter is really about getting a grip on time as money, time being managed as you would try to manage money, and the conversion of time into money. The other point I would make is that a lot of people's success or failure, the amount of money they make, where two people in the same profession have very different incomes, it is largely about how they manage exclusive attention. So I can assure you that writers, for example, Stephen King, James Patterson, some of the highest earning writers of our time are not doing any of their writing on a laptop in a Starbucks. Now, a bunch of poorly paid, stupid people trying to be writers, that's exactly where you can find them. And the difference is exclusive attention. And so it's important to manage your time and other people's access to it and to you to give as much exclusive attention to important things as you possibly can.
So a term you use, Dan, in the book that I really loved, it's called investors think. So talk about that, because you're really already talking about it, but it's an unusual term.
Yeah, so most people think as laborers and wage earners. They have a job mentality. Even those who start small businesses to be their own bosses, they really have a job mentality, and that governs all their behavior. They go to a place of business pretty much at the same time every morning. They leave pretty much at the same time at the end of every day. They react all day long to whoever comes in, whatever happens. They may carry a briefcase instead of a lunch pail. But basically, they function in the same way. You have people who become business owners, or they become executives, or they become professionals, and they may now have minions, and so they delegate. They don't just do. They manage. They don't just do. But they are still very much controlled by everyone and everything else going on around them, and their time is consumed and spent. When you really get to very successful entrepreneurs, they really are entrepreneur investors. Sam Zell, the great real estate guy who has a new book out called Am I Being Too Subtle? Sam makes the point, I often have made the point, that whether you think about it this way or not, every morning when you get up and you decide to stay in the business you're already in, you invest in it all over again. Every time you decide to engage in an activity, you invest in it. Even if you don't invest cash out of pocket, you invest a different kind of currency, which is your time. And so really successful people think about this in terms of investment. Is this person, this relationship, is this task, is this activity, is this project, is this business worthy of the time investment calculated as money that it is requiring or is likely to require? So they have an investment mentality. And by that, they also create investment criteria. So Warren Buffett doesn't get up in the morning and read the Wall Street Journal and randomly decide to invest in or buy a company. He has a process for this, a criteria, a series of litmus tests that a potential investment must pass, hurdles it must get over. His business partner, Charlie Munger, Charlie says that sometimes their best week is a week when they do nothing. They invest in nothing. Nothing passed the test, and they have all their money in the same place on Friday that it was on Monday. The same thing is really true of time. Some of your best weeks can be when you reject all sorts of requests and demands for you to invest time, and by your criteria, you calculate that would be a really bad investment. So you can go to lunch with somebody you might learn something from, or you can go to lunch with somebody you have no prayer at all of learning anything from, and why would you do the second and not do the first? Going to lunch with somebody is going to cost you 2 hours. Eating by yourself at your desk is going to cost you half an hour. And if you're not going to be any smarter, or you're not going to have contacts you didn't have, you're not going to have some productive return on investment from the 2 hours, by all means, just do the 30 minutes you need to keep from passing out from low blood sugar and get on with something that is productive. And so this is the investor mentality about time and access and yours and others' use of your time.
Well, You and I have known each other a very long time. We talk about this a lot. Nothing could be more true than what you're saying. However, it flies in the face of current reality, yes, of what people think is proper use of time.
Well, look, I don't honestly think most people even think about it, period. the people that have been attracted to your call to. But look, I don't think most people think about it at all. They really just do.
React.
So they, you know, they are not really at all smart. They're not even really instinctual. You know, if you turn a pig loose in a big field, other than rolling in it a couple times, he will migrate instinctively away from the dirt where there is grass and trees and bushes because he's more likely to find food there. I don't think most people are even this instinctual. They're just not discerning at all. And beyond that, the newest thing that affects and infects everybody, of course, is the constant connectivity that has come with devices and the portal that they are to an unimaginable quantity and array of time-wasting activities and to people and their demands. And many people are actually emotionally and chemically addicted to such things as people posting and liking their social media. So they are checking it 48 times a day to see if that has occurred. And they are doing something with it 48 times a day to make that occur. It's the exact same addictive technology that is embedded in slot machines and casinos. And it has the exact same effect on people. So it's so much easier for people to totally lose grip on time now than it was before these mobile devices and everything that they are a portal to. I mean, adults before this rarely played games for 4 or 5 hours a day on weekdays. If they played games, they played games in the evening or on the weekend, and they had them stored away in a game closet in their home. They weren't carrying the closet around with them in a knapsack everywhere they went, so that the milliseconds they weren't being stimulated by anything else, they got sucked into playing a game. That's not how we lived. People did not lug all their entertainment around with them everywhere they went. There was, as the old axiom is, a place for everything and everything in its place. Well, all those places and borders and divisions of use of time have all evaporated. And it takes deliberate intent, a willingness not to be peer pressured and intimidated and easily distracted and seduced, more of an iron will not to fall victim now to this than it did before it existed. I mean, wasting time just talking to anybody and everybody on the phone, if you think about it, only happened in certain hours because we all had landlines. So you couldn't do it while you were driving, walking across a parking lot, sitting at a dinner table in a restaurant with somebody. You were prohibited from all of this stupid behavior because the equipment didn't exist to enable you. Hardly anybody took 2-3 hours a day out of their work day to go to the mall and go shopping, because it got noticed. I mean, if you were absent for 3 hours a day, every day, from your job, or even as the owner of the business, from the business, people like noticed. Now everybody does 3 hours a day of shopping on Amazon. And if Amazon could be blocked, which I don't wish, by the way, because I'm a shareholder, but if Amazon could be blocked in every workplace, so you could only access Amazon on your own time, Amazon probably wouldn't even exist. It thrives in large part because of its usurpation of time outside of its place. And so people are just besieged and beset and immersed in this new, as you said, a new reality that is very damaging and damning. It makes the job of managing yourself and managing your time and managing your productivity in order to achieve your most meaningful goals infinitely difficult than it was a decade ago. And the reason the book's been revised again and really thoroughly updated this time is because of that massively multiplied level of difficulty.
Well, I was going to ask you about Chapter 14, which you're really talking about now. So we're going to go ahead and go into that because you're absolutely right. You know, not only is it very hard for us as entrepreneurs, but we've lost control of our staff with all this time wasting. You know, they're shopping, they're, God only knows what they're doing, but productivity in the average company or office has plummeted because everybody wants to be checking their social media. They, as you said, they want to be liking and engaging, and they somehow or another, the new thing is all about everything is relationships. Well, how about your relationship to money? So let's go ahead and really get into the name of your chapter on chapter of your book is Taming Tech and Surviving the Social Media Swamp. I kind of like that. And your first quote here is by David Sachs, an author, and he says, "Take email. It was supposed to make us all so much more productive. Did it? Or maybe it just enabled us to send and receive a lot of email."
Yeah, well, this is increasingly, I mean, I started, you know, speaking about all this a decade ago, and a whole lot of research and a whole lot of other people have caught up to me, and the failure of things like email to actually improve productivity is being acknowledged more and more. Companies like Google are taking half a day a week when they prohibit anybody from emailing anybody and demand that they get up, walk around, go see somebody and talk to them. Actually, if you were really privy to everything going on inside Silicon Valley that is so much different from what they want everybody else to do, it very much mirrors tobacco company executives who quit smoking as soon as they understood how damaging it was, but continued to push smoking on everybody else. It's the same stuff. The number one private high school, private academy in Silicon Valley that all the Silicon Valley executives send their kids to prohibits devices on campus. However, the school the schools most people send their kids to demand devices on campus and force kids to do their homework digitally rather than in analog. So this will be, I mean, it is my prediction that Facebook, et cetera, if they survive the other kinds of scrutiny they're under, they will be a decade and a half, no more than that, they will be tobacco companies. Their executives are all going to be testifying in front of Congress of what they knew and when they knew it. There's going to be massive litigation. You'll see TV commercials, because there will still be TV, I promise you. there will be TV commercials by law firms rounding up class action lawsuit opportunities, saying if you've become addicted and you've been unable to work, earn a living, run your business, your marriage has been destroyed by your addiction to social media or to the smartphone, call us because we can get you money. Massive litigation is going to occur. Some of them will suffer enormous stock value drops because reality is going to catch up to this. And to the point you make about the people around you. So one issue is controlling you, and that's vital. But then secondly is controlling people that you rely on to do anything. So, for example, there's an enormous stigma about driving drunk. And if you get in a hired car, Uber, God forbid, in my opinion, or Lyft, or a sedan service, or a taxi cab, and the driver has a fifth of whiskey and is swilling out of it while he is driving, you are probably going to protest.
Yes. Yes.
However, most people will ride in their Uber car or their limousine or their taxi cab while the driver is talking on the phone and texting, and they will not protest. However, all the empirical research says that actually the impairment is the same or worse and more dangerous with the person on the phone than it would be the person swilling the whiskey. So we accept stuff from employees, other people around us, that has become socially acceptable norms, business acceptable norms, that we ought not to accept. And same thing, if you get on an airplane and see the pilot standing in the doorway texting or yammering away on his smartphone, you don't think anything of it. If he was standing there drinking booze, you would think about it. However, he's taking that into the cabin with him, and he is going to have it with him while he is flying the damn plane. And it ought not be permitted, any more than in many workplaces, your employees should be allowed to have their phone at their workplace, because you can't track what they're doing on it. If they're on a computer, at least you can install tracking software and you can scrutinize what the hell they're doing. The phone should be in a locker and you should go get it on a break, just like cigarettes. And you should go outside, indulge your addiction outside the workplace so you don't pollute the damn thing. Come back in, put it away in a locker, and go back to work. Now, have I described anything that 99% of employers are willing to do? Of course not. Have I just described something 99% of employers should do? Absolutely. And, you know, we tolerate this really without thinking about what it equates to. People have come to this idea that because it's online and because it involves a device, it's different. And no, using your device on my time to go to Amazon is the same as leaving on my time to go to the mall. And I wouldn't allow the second. So why would I allow the first? And so productivity in the workplace and attention to detail in the workplace. So the less obvious damage by all this is the skyrocketing rise in attention to detail-based mistakes. many of which get shrugged off, some of which can't get shrugged off. And there's a high level of tolerance for them now that, again, did not exist before these devices. And the last point made in this chapter is, if you won't control it, there's a litmus test in the chapter to tell if you're an addict. It's not unique to this. I mean, addiction is addiction is addiction is addiction. So the person who is addicted to casino gaming and leaves the workplace, extends their lunch, doesn't eat on lunch, and goes and plays slot machines instead, plays poker online, will eventually lose their job, lose their house, lose their family. This addiction works the same way, and all addictions do. It really doesn't matter whether it's booze, drugs, sex, video gaming, shopping, et cetera, et cetera. If you take the test in the chapter, you can tell whether you're addicted or not. And if you observe the people around you through the prism of this test, you can tell whether you have an addict on your hand or not. And if you discover you have a cocaine addict in your business, you really need to get rid of them because they will lie, cheat, steal, fail, create all kinds of mistakes, et cetera. And everybody kind of knows that about a cocaine addict. But most people don't react the same way when they have a social media addict in their employ. And yet they should, because all of the same damage is destined. So the test in this chapter is useful for yourself and it's useful for others. And understanding that we are really dealing with a addiction epidemic at this point that is certainly equivalent to smoking and is probably equivalent to the much ballyhooed opioid addiction that we have on our hands in this country. And they're next in line. The drug companies, the drug company executives, the doctors who have pushed this, hidden what they knew and when they knew it, massively overprescribed and overpromoted, et cetera, they're up next. But close behind them are the people who have pushed this upon us. And in essence, if you permit it in your workplace, you are enabling dangerous and harmful addiction. That's what you're doing. If controlling it forces you to hire and fire five times as many people in order to find keepers, if it requires you to rejigger the economics of your business so you can create better paying opportunities for people so you have more leverage with them, if it requires you to have more supervision, whatever it requires is actually a bargain compared to the cancer that it creates left unchecked in a company. I mean, without giving you details, I have been right in the middle of it twice this week with a bunch of people who should know better and a couple of businesses in which it shouldn't be in play, and yet it is, and the price being paid is significant, and I'm not in a good mood about it, and there are going to be ramifications. And we're coming to a very dangerous level of tolerance for actually very dangerous behavior, looping all the way back to your Uber driver on his damn phone while he's driving. It's up to you. If you don't want to be run into a tree, it's up to you to be the guy or gal who says, hey, I want you to put the phone away. I want both hands on the wheel, one in the 10 o'clock position and one in the 2 o'clock position, and I want you paying attention to the road. that's your job until you get me to my destination. Now, you're not going to have a fan, but you dramatically improve your odds of getting to your destination in one piece. And statistically, you're pretty safe if you don't do that. But statistics don't really matter when you're the one crashed into a tree. And the same thing is true inside your company, metaphorically being crashed into trees.
In your book, you said there was a study in USA Today in April of 2017. It said 30% of all Americans admit that they can't go more than 30 minutes without checking their phones before feeling what you said Mel Brooks dubbed as high anxiety. You also had a statistic in here that 34 million Americans play video games an average of 22 hours a week, and another 5 million play 40 hours or more a week. That includes adults, not just children. And another quote before I get to another question is, it says, your addiction makes you behave rudely, boyishly, extremely narcissistically, harms relationships, takes the place of relationships, and even causes behavior that is dangerous to yourself and others. But you realize it, but you continue anyway. As a employer and an author of an assistant program for entrepreneurs, I can tell you, Dan, that I've learned now when hiring people to really move up front that whole section of my part of my business about cell phones not allowed in the office, because I have found that I have candidates that I would like to hire, but once I break the news to them that they can only check their cell phones on breaks and at lunch, they actually turn down the job because they are so addicted and feel so entitled to be able to check their email anytime they want, because they tell me their excuse is, what if there's an emergency? And, of course, I say, we have two landlines, a fax line. We have ways to contact us. If anybody in your family is in an emergency situation, they can call our regular office, which you are here, and tell us. So it is truly an epidemic of what I call actually entitlement now, that you can do any damn thing you want at the office.
Well, so it's not new. And, again, addiction is addiction is addiction. And so there was a time when the transition away from unfettered smoking was in its infancy, that people turned down jobs because they weren't allowed to smoke in the workplace. And this is just the same thing again. And it is just as insidious, actually more so, because for the most part, the smoking only damaged the smoker, and by secondhand smoke, the other people. It really didn't inject massive amounts of errors and other kinds of damage and hazard into the work being performed. This now not only damages the person, in a way damages the other people around them because it's contagious behavior, but it also injects harm and risk into the work itself. So from the employer standpoint, having an office where everybody was allowed to smoke was far less harmful than having an office where everybody is allowed to engage in all of these behaviors made possible by their device. Being driven across town in a car by someone smoking, yeah, the secondhand smoke harmed you, but, like, you had to do it a lot. I mean, it takes a lot of secondhand smoke. being driven across town by somebody texting and talking on their phone and arguing with their girlfriend or placing their football bets or making their stock trades while they're driving you. You can be harmed by that the very first time you're in a car with some nitwit doing it. You don't need cumulative effect. So this is really, it has the same basis as every other addiction. But it is far worse for the employer than almost any other kind of addiction. Possibly coke. I mean, serious drug addiction would be in the same category. And you're right. The enforcement of it, the prohibition of it, the unempowering of it, will cost you employees. It will cost you clients. It may cost you customers. But again, that cost is a real bargain. And the other thing about this is it's almost impossible to permit it in the people around you and not have it backwards infect you. I mean, the principle of association is like the law of gravity. It's really hard to defy it. And if you do defy it, you defy it for very brief moments at a time. So there are magicians, David Blaine leaps to mind, who can defy gravity for 30 seconds and literally levitate above the ground. You don't see him doing the trick, though, 30 stories in the air, stepping off the roof of a building. There are basketball players, Michael Jordan, to a degree, LeBron now. There are some receivers in the NFL who briefly defy gravity. They have vertical leap and hold that is really quite remarkable. But still, you don't see any of them demoing it, stepping off the roof of a building because it's too temporal. Well, the principle of association works very much the same way. So, you know, the Chinese proverb of lie down with dogs, wake up with fleas. It's inviolate. Yes, if you have an iron will, you can occasionally hang out with a really toxic person, a really negative person, a really dumb person, and that time be limited, that time be occasional, and you can be unaffected. But if you hang out, if you are surrounded by, if you are engaged with a bunch of those people on a frequent, if not constant, basis, your own behavior will be sucked into their vortex. So if you have people come into your office, or they're in a meeting in your conference room, or they're at lunch with you, and their smartphones are on the table and on the desk, and they are glancing at them, and they are checking them, and they are hearing various noises from them, and you tolerate it, I promise you, it will not be long before your phone is on the desk and on the table. You will not be able to long resist the pull of that gravity when you expose yourself to it on a regular basis. So this, you know, the course saying is, you know, shit flushes uphill. This is so personally dangerous. The gradual acceptance of, and that's what is going on, it's very deliberate from the owners and promoters of it. This is what Zig used to call cooked in the squat. And so a lot of people would know the cooked in the squat story, which is if you take a frog and you throw him into the biggest, deepest pot of boiling water you got, he has the ability to jump out, and he does. If you put him in just a real small frying pan that he could walk out of, but you start with cold water, and you ever so slowly raise the temperature, the dumb frog stays in the water and is cooked to death in the squat. That's what's going on with all this stuff. People are having the temperature turned up ever so gradually, and they are ever so slowly accepting all sorts of behavior by others and themselves that will eventually cook them to death in the squat. Many people are already cooked nearly to death, and if you let other people have this happen to them, but they surround you, the idea that you are not going to be affected by it is delusional.
Now that we have talked about that, let's talk about Chapter 3, How to Drive a Stake Through the Hearts of the Time Vampires Out to Suck You Dry. Let's give some strategy on how to protect yourself from some of these vampires. For example, you know, people who are always interrupting you, they need a minute, they want a meeting. So let's just give our listeners some hard scripts of what they should do.
Well, sort of in advance of that, the best thing is not to be available. So, you know, the best answer to most of the time vampires described in this chapter is to strictly limit their access. Most of my highest income clients actually spend very little time in the offices where their people work. And it's easier and easier to do that now because teleconferencing is easy, not painful, Skype, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing is to limit the access. The second thing is impose procedures. So, for example, the person that used to come and hang out in the doorway 10 times a day and say, I just need a minute, he's still there if you're there. If you're not, he will send you 10 emails during the day. It's the same thing. And if you don't have a rule that he gets one email a day, you're going to get 10. So the second part of this is procedural. The third part, now to scripts, is you actually need to think through the different kinds of time vampirism and vampires who inflict themselves upon you. And you need to develop scripts that alter their behavior, that constrain them and train them about how to access you and how to communicate with you, and then enforce them. I suggest 3 strikes and you're out, but you can pick your level of enforcement. But so the Mr. I've Got a Minute gets, I don't have a minute. What we do have is twice a week a 20-minute scheduled meeting, and please come with a list of everything we need to talk about, ranked by priority, and we'll deal with it during the next meeting, which I remind you is tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Bye. Now, a relatively smart, capable, and coachable person will only need that a few times, and they'll get it. An incredibly stupid or incredibly defiant persons will need more than a few times. So many more than a few times that the best thing to do is just replace them with somebody who is teachable and coachable. And you know, part of this is deciding pretty harshly whose time is most important in your enterprise, in your world. And you do not need to be fair about this. This is not about fairness. This is about time value. So there are plenty of people who I, if I need to, will pick up the phone and call. And more often than not, because they answer their phones, I'll get them. And I don't really care what I'm interrupting at their end, because my time is infinitely more valuable than theirs, certainly to me. And an immediate answer is very useful to me. So I'll impose that on them. They don't have the same privilege with me. And they know it, and they behave accordingly. Whether or not they ever think about this as injustice, I don't know. Nor do I care. I don't think it's injustice. I think it's rational valuing of whose time is more important. But whether they think of it as injustice or not really doesn't matter to me. But they will. Some of the people on this list might have my direct fax. They will fax me. Others don't even have that. They will go through my office, and they will get a call scheduled. But it doesn't prohibit me from disrupting their activity to get what I want. And if you don't make these decisions and you operate this democratically and with equal justice for all, you lower the value of your time to whatever the value of the other person's time is. So for me to let the guy that takes care of my cars call me whenever he feels like it or wants to or randomly would be beyond stupid. It lowers the value of my time to the value of his time. The value of my time is over $3,000 an hour. The value of his time is probably less than $100. Now, for me to call him and disrupt him makes perfect sense. I need an answer. I need an answer right now. I could probably get it right now because unlike me, he answers his phone. I'm only disrupting $100 an hour time. My time is worth over $3,000. Makes perfect sense. Is it socially just? No. But so what? It's time value necessary if you want maximum productivity for yourself.
So let's just briefly talk about the dark side of instant communications and the effects it has on the average business person.
Well, so the easier it is for people to communicate with you on a whim, the more communication by whim you get. So if you're sitting in your office with the door open, people will stream in to ask you questions, most of which they should be able to answer themselves or they should be fired. But it's really your fault because you made yourself accessible. So the same thing is true with any other kind of communication by whim, regardless of how it is done. If you let people text you unrestricted, every time they have what I call a brain fart, you get a text. If they have to put it all in a memo and can only send you three memos a week, 80% of the stuff they would have texted you about, you never even know about because they handle it. And now you are using your time on more important things. and you are de facto kind of forcing them to use their time back. The consequence of not doing this, of being vulnerable, is that your productivity is destroyed. Your stress level goes up because you are constantly being interrupted, focus disrupted, starting over. It takes you longer to do what you need or want to do. You're always behind. You're pressed. You're missing commitments and deadlines. You are being forced into all sorts of disreputable and unproductive behavior by permitting others to behave toward you in an unproductive way. So the consequences are about sanity, which you noted is in the title of the book. It literally is the consequences can affect your emotional health. The consequences certainly can affect your capability. They can affect the quality of what it is that you do. They can affect certainly how all that converts into income. They can affect your reputation, which affects income. So the consequences are really quite great. And again, it is why if you were privy to what the CEOs of the top 20 tech companies and social media companies do and permit and how they manage access, you would be shocked, because it would fit in this book. Now, that's not what they're selling, and that's not what they're encouraging you to do, but that is absolutely what they are doing. And so if you will not exercise procedural control over how people take time from you, you might as well just bring all your money in, put it in a big box, and let people take from it as they feel the need or entitlement or desire to do so. Just drain your bank accounts, pile it all in a box, and put a sign up that says, take what you need. Because you're doing the same thing if you put all your time in a big box with a sign on it that says, take what you need.
Well, you and I could talk about this forever. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I do have a quote I'd like from your book to share with people that kind of sums up a lot of what you're saying. Your quote is, we do not get paid for our ideas, our intentions, our thinking things over, for even trying, or even for doing. In the real world, there is no A for effort. We only get paid for done. I like that. It kind of sums up everything. Folks, you need to get this book. I'm very serious. The No BS Time Management for Entrepreneurs, and the subtitle, which is very important, The Ultimate No Holds Barred Kick Butt Take No Prisoners Guide to Time Productivity and Sanity. I've known Dan in many, many years, and I can tell you this book, every single page is chocked full of usable, eye-opening information. This is, if you only buy one book, you need to buy this particular book, because it will give you permission to actually take your life back. Dan, as always, you are fantastic. I deeply appreciate your time and your wisdom. And this new book really is, I think it's number 17 or 18 in your No BS series.
Yeah, I've lost track, so you're probably right.
I was counting in the back of all the listing titles. I think I counted 17. But anyway, all of Dan Kennedy's books are fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. We deeply appreciate it.
Thanks, Lee.
Thank you. This is Lee Miltier, calling it a wrap. Talk to you next month.
Thanks for joining Darren Garman's Paranoid Banker Podcast. For investment questions, comments, or to get in touch with Darren, go to www.garminblog.com.